Okay. So this is the beginning of this week's Sidra, the Sidra of Vayigash. We can see where it is a continuation of last week, right? In last week's Sidra, the closing was that Joseph had his brother Binyamin arrested on a trumped-up charge of having stolen his royal goblet. And Yehuda stepped forward to make an offer that he would stand in for Benjamin as Joseph's prisoner, providing that Joseph would allow Benjamin to return home because of a promise that he had made to their father to be responsible for him. Okay? So Joseph declines this offer, and he says in the closing verse of last week's Sidra, right, "Far be it from me that I should do so. The man in whose hand the cup is found, that was Benjamin, he will be my bondservant, but as for you, go up in peace to your father." So this is the point at which our current Sidra begins, as Yehuda persists, and he steps forward, he approaches Joseph, and he says to him, "Be Adoni, please, my lord, all right, allow me to speak in your presence. Va'al yichar apecha be'avdecha, and do not be angry with me. Ki chamocha kefaro, because I consider you to be the equivalent of Pharaoh." Okay. And then he begins by summarizing, essentially by summarizing the events that had brought them up to this point. He reminds Joseph that on their previous visit, Joseph had asked the brothers whether they had any other brothers or whether their father was alive. And they replied to him by saying, "We have an elderly father and a younger brother whose other brother died, so that he is the sole surviving son of his mother, and he is the beloved of our father." So obviously he is trying to pluck, as it were, at Joseph's heartstrings, saying that the relationship between their elderly father, Jacob, and the youngest child, Benjamin, is such a special relationship that to keep Benjamin away from his father would have disastrous results. And yet Joseph persisted, and he said to the brothers, "No, bring him down. I want to see him." Okay. To which they replied by saying, right, "The boy cannot leave his father. For if he should leave his father would die." Okay? By the way, parenthetically, take a good look at the Hebrew and take a second look at the English and see that the English says something that, strictly speaking, is not in the Hebrew. The second half of the verse in the Hebrew says, "Ve'azav et aviv," if he were to leave his father, and that clearly is Benjamin, right, he would die. Right, that's an excellent example of what your ninth grade English composition teacher would call an instance of unclear pronoun referent. There are two possible subjects for the pronoun: he, Jacob, the father, and Benjamin, the son. And from the verse itself, it's not particularly clear which of them would die as a result of their separation. So the translator here, by saying his father would die, is obviously engaging in more than an act of translation. This is an act of interpretation as well. Nevertheless, this is the situation, right? Joseph said, "Nonetheless, if you do not bring your younger brother back with you, you will no longer be able to approach me," which means no more purchasing grain with 5 more years left to the famine. Not that they necessarily knew that there were 5 years of famine left, but they certainly knew that the famine was a formidable one. Okay. So this is the situation. So what we have here essentially is a confrontation between Joseph and Judah. That explains the choice of this Haftarah, which I will now move us to. This Haftarah consists of the second half of chapter 37 in the book of the prophet Yechezkel, Ezekiel. And as you can see, I have kind of given it a subtitle, right? Ending Sibling Rivalry. Now, if we take a step back and we recall the events of the last 3 or 4 weeks in terms of weekly Torah readings, we know that even if there was no, well, we know that there was at least one direct confrontation between Judah and Joseph, but we know that there was far from tranquility and harmony amongst the brothers. Okay, you may recall from 2 weeks ago from the Sidra of Vayeshev that we were told that Joseph's brothers were jealous of him, that Joseph seemed to have been comfortable only with, or at least more with, the sons of Jacob's two concubines, with the children of Bilhah and Zilpah, than he was with the children of Jacob's other full wife, Leah. And that, of course, if we go back to the 2 weeks before that, to the Sidra of Vayetze, is certainly on account of the fact that Jacob was enamored of Rachel and not of Leah, that Leah was, so to speak, pawned off on him by her father, Lavan. And therefore, we can well understand that Jacob was more attached to the children of his more beloved wife, Rachel, than he was attached to the children of his less beloved wife, Leah. So there was a friction there, okay? Then we get to the point where the brothers plot initially to do Joseph in. And here, if you may recall, it was Reuben who tried to work some sort of a strategy to get them to spare Joseph so that he could return him to his father. And there we see Reuben acting in his capacity as the eldest child, right? And arguably, if not for other events in his life, particularly one that had to do with, at least the way the Torah describes it, as some shenanigans that related to the relationship between his father and his concubine, right? We would have expected Reuben to be Jacob's heir. And yet we know that Reuben essentially disappears from the picture. Okay? If we wait until next week's Torah reading, we'll get it spelled out to us as Jacob actually says to Reuben, right, that you are a kochi v'reishit oni, that you are indeed my firstborn, right? But pachas kamayim al totar ki alita mishkevei avicha. But you act thoughtlessly, and particular whatever it is intended by alita mishkevei avicha, as I said, something having to do with the relationship between Jacob and his concubines. Reuven apparently lost the birthright. Okay. But still, between Reuben and Judah, there are Simeon and Levi, Shimon and Levi. So even if Reuven lost the birthright, it should have passed to the second born, Shimon, or to the third born, Levi. And yet we know that Shimon and Levi also have strikes against them, so to speak, due to their jeopardizing the lives of their parents and their family in the episode involving their sister Dina and the people of Shechem, right? And for that too, when we get to next week's Torah reading, Jacob will say to them, "Bisodam al tavo nafshi bihi kahalam al techad kvodi, ki va'apam harugu ish uvirtzonam ikru shor." That on account of the massacre that they wrought in the city of Shechem, so apparently they too lost their shot at the birthright. So if we go down the list and we've eliminated Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, then the next one would be Yehuda. And sure enough, in the story involving the sale of Joseph, it is Judah who finally persuades his brother, Mabetza ki naharog et achinu v'chisinu et damo, that there is no advantage would accrue to us if we killed our brother. L'chuvinim karenu la Yishma'ilim, let's go and sell him to the Ishmaelites. So Judah has had that interaction, so to speak, with Joseph previously. And when Jacob was reluctant to send Benjamin down to Egypt with his brothers, as the viceroy of Egypt had requested, Reuven first tries to get his father to entrust Binyamin into his hands, but true to his reputation of acting before he thinks about it, he makes the ridiculous offer to his father that if I don't return Benjamin to you, at Shnei Banai Tamit, then you can take the lives of my two sons. Okay, so clearly Jacob did not accept that offer. And then Judah steps forward and he makes the offer saying, Anochi Erevenu, I will stand surety for him, Miadi Tevakeshenu, and I will be personally responsible for him. And Jacob, having no choice because the family sorely needed provisions, gave in and entrusted Benjamin into the hands of Judah. That explains why it is now Judah of all the brothers who steps forward and basically takes the risk of confronting the viceroy of Egypt in order to secure the person of their brother Binyamin. Now, this is, again, just another in what continues later on, not later on in the Torah, but later on in Nevi'im, to be an ongoing tension in the relationship between Judah and Joseph. We know that the monarchy, the longest lasting monarchy in the Jewish people, consisted of the kingdom of Judah. Okay? But we also know two other things. The second of the two is that throughout much of the existence of the kingdom of Judah, there was a rival kingdom in the north of the land of Israel, the kingdom whose first ruler was Yerovam ben Nevat, who came from the tribe of Ephraim. And indeed, another name for the northern kingdom of Israel was the kingdom of Ephraim. That's the second thing that we know. The first thing that we know is that, again, while the longest lasting monarchy in the land of Israel was that of the tribe of Judah, it was not the first monarchy to be established in the land of Israel. The first monarchy to be established in the land of Israel was that of King Saul. Now, King Saul was not of the tribe of Ephraim. King Saul was not of the tribe of Joseph, but King Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin, who along with Joseph were the sons of Rachel. So, if we've seen that all along, that Jacob's relationship with his two principal wives, Rachel and Leah, seems to have affected his relationships with the children he had through them, we can see, as Ramban said famously, Ma'ase avot siman levanim, that deeds or activities of patriarchs play themselves out again in the lives of their children. So this same competition between the children of the immediate children of Leah and the immediate children of Rachel is destined to play itself out throughout the major part of biblical Jewish history. Okay. The prophet Yechezkel lives during the period of the Babylonian exile, and his prophecies are about the renewal of Jewish monarchy and the renewal of the Jewish religion through the construction of a new second temple. Here, and we're finally getting to the text, you can see that it begins in verse 15 of chapter 37. Perhaps even at this moment, some of you are saying to yourselves, chapter 37 in the book of Yechezkel, that sounds awfully familiar. It sounds like I ought to know what the content is of the first 14 verses in that chapter. So if you remember, then you're a step ahead of everyone else. If you don't remember, I'm not going to tell you right now, give you a chance to grab a Tanakh and have a look. Okay. Just bear in mind, as I said, that what we're going to read now is really a follow-up on what is previous to this. Okay. So here the word of God comes to Yechezkel, and it says as follows in the second verse, Va'ata ben Adam. Ben Adam, son of man, or if you wish, mortal. That's the way the prophet Yechezkel designates himself throughout his book. Time and time and time again, he refers to himself not as Yechezkel, not as Hanavi, but he refers to himself as Ben Adam. Okay. And God instructs him to take Eitz Echad, to take a piece of wood, Uchtov Alav, and on this piece of wood, he is to inscribe Li Yehuda. That word, the word Li Yehuda. Okay. And you notice that I highlighted that in yellow. And then the instructions continue, and he's told to take a second piece of wood. And on the second piece of wood, he is to write Li Yosef Eitz Ephraim. So here we have the prophet Yechezkel holding two pieces of wood. On one, he has written the name Judah. On the other, he's written the names of Joseph and his son Ephraim. Remember that I mentioned that the northern kingdom of Israel, right, that was established by a descendant of Yosef, is known either as the kingdom of Ephraim and sometimes as the house of Joseph. Okay. And what is he supposed to do with these two pieces of wood? In verse 17, he's supposed to join these two pieces of wood together, v'karav otam echad el echad, and somehow, either symbolically, or maybe even miraculously, they will become eitz echad, they will be fused together into a single piece of wood, v'ayula achadim biyadecha, and they will be unified in his hands. So you notice that I took the yellow underline and the blue underline, and I combined them into a green underline. Okay. Now, by the way, just as an interesting note, wooden slates were used very widely throughout the ancient Near East as writing surfaces. You know, we're not really acquainted with it because we think of writing as being either words that are chiseled in stone, right, like monumental inscriptions, or we think perhaps of pottery shards that have words written on them. We don't quickly. Wooden slates for writing don't come quickly to mind for a very simple reason, right? They don't last, right? Archaeologists dig up pottery shards by the tens of thousands. Archaeologists dig up monumental inscriptions, not by the thousands, not even, well, by the hundreds, right? But it's very rare, if ever, that they're going to discover an inscribed wooden slate. And yet, as I said, we have evidence, literary evidence, that these were widely used in the ancient world for writing exercises. And I brought you here just an example from an early rabbinic text that tells us about the education of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, although he was 40 years old, was illiterate. So before he could become Rabbi Akiva, he minimally had to learn how to read and write. And he learned it, as we're told, by using a wooden slate. Right? The text says that Rabbi Akiva and his son actually shared a wooden slate. Right? Rabbi Akiva took hold of the slate on one edge, and his son took hold of it at the other. And then the teacher wrote the alphabet on the slate, and then they studied it, and then they were able to duplicate it, and then they were able to go on. And that's how children in general in those days learned literacy. Okay, so we have the prophet Ezekiel taking these two pieces of wood, the Judah piece and the Joseph piece, and combining them. What does this symbolize? So indeed, God tells the prophet, that when your audience turns to you and says, "Halo tagid lanu ma'elalach," don't keep us in suspense, Ezekiel. What is this all about? What does this symbolize? He is told to tell them as follows. God says, "Hine ani lokeach et etz Yosef asher biyad Ephraim," that I'm going to take on the one hand this slate of wood representing Joseph and Ephraim, v'shivtei Yisrael chavirav, and the balance of the people of Israel that were represented by that kingdom, v'natati otam alav et etz Yehuda, and upon them, or together with them, I will put the piece of wood that is inscribed to Judah, va'asitim le'etz echad, and you will combine them together, right? Va'ayu ha'etzim asher tichtov aleihem biyadecha le'eneihem. You should do all of this in their presence in public. And here, just to remind us that this symbolism of many being fused together into one, right, is something that we're acquainted with, or at least acquainted with it again in rabbinic literature. And I cite here the well-known example, Rashi's citation, which is actually from the Talmud in Masechet Chulin, of how it was that that what appeared to be several or many stones that Jacob set about his head when he went to sleep in Bethel and had that fabulous dream about the ladder or the ramp and the angels going up and down on it. It says that when he awoke in the morning, vayikach et ha'even asher sam rashotav, that he took the single stone that he had placed by his head and he raised it up as a monument. Wait a second. It said vayikach me'avnei hamakom, that he took from among the stones of the place. How did many stones come to be ha'evin, a single stone? And the Talmudic Agadah responds by saying that the stones were arguing amongst themselves for having the merit of supporting Jacob's head. Thereupon, God made them straightaway into a single stone. So we can see that, again, this idea of taking two or more separate items and fusing them together is a recognizable symbol. And you can see that I asked myself the rhetorical question, right? Could it possibly have been that Jacob, when he went to sleep, put 12 stones about his head? It says, me'avneham akom, doesn't tell us how many, right? Could he have put as many as 12 stones? And could the rabbis then have thought that the fusion of 12 stones into one was somehow just another symbol that Jacob had to interpret along with the angels and the ladder? I don't know, possibly. But here we go on, and we come now to the heart of it, which is the interpretation of the vision. And the interpretation of the vision is that the fusing together of the two wooden slates represents both the political and spiritual unification of the Jewish people. Daber Aleihem, God instructs the prophet Yechezkel to continue and to tell his audience in his God's name, Hinei ani lokeach et b'nei Yisrael miben hagoyim asher halachu sham, that I'm going to gather the Jewish people together from amongst all of the different countries to which they have been exiled. Now remember, at this point in time, Ezekiel himself is living in Babylonia amongst the Jews who had been exiled from Judah and Jerusalem. But there was an earlier exile that had taken place some 150 years earlier, where the kingdom of Joseph Ephraim, right, the northern kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes, had been exiled by the Assyrians, right, to some place in Asia Minor. So when the prophet now says, in the name of God, that God is going to gather together all of the Jewish people from all of the places to which they have been exiled, the Heviti Otam El Admatam, and he's going to restore them to their own land, we don't know yet, but it's going to become abundantly clear that he's speaking not only about his immediate Jewish neighbors in Babylonia, the people who are exiled from Judah and from Jerusalem, but he's speaking about all of the Jewish exiles, including what we commonly refer to now as the 10 lost tribes. Vasiti otam, in verse 22, Lugoy echad ba'aretz beharei Yisrael. But when the Jews return or brought back to the land of Israel from their exile, they will not resume, as it were, their separate existences as a separate northern kingdom and a separate southern kingdom, but rather they will now be fused together into a goy echad, into one nation, umelech echad yihyeh l'chulam lemelech, and they will not have two separate rulers, one living in Jerusalem for the southern kingdom and the other living in Shomron, Samaria, for the northern kingdom, but they will have but a single king, v'lo yihyu od l'shnei goyim, they will no longer, for at least all political purposes, be regarded as two separate nations, v'lo yechatzu od l'shtei mamlachot od, neither will they again be divided into two separate kingdoms. So they will be reunited, they will be fused together politically. But there's more than just a political perspective to this, there is a spiritual one as well. And that picks up now in the final verse. V'lo yitama'u od, and no longer will they defile themselves, b'gilu lehem uv'shikutzehem uv'chol pish'ehem, by means of their idols and by means of all things that are detestable and by means of all of the sins, all of the crimes, all of the transgressions that they commit, v'hosha'ati otam mikol moshevotehem, God will deliver them from all of the places outside of the land of Israel, asher chatu'u vahem, in which they were prone to sin, and tiharti otam, and in the process of bringing them back to the land of Israel, he will purify them, v'hayu li la'am, and they will once again be, they will consider themselves to be the people of God. Va'ani, says God, Eyelahem le'lohim, I will resume seeing myself as the God of Israel. So the fact that Judah, right, and Joseph were, I'll use the term, reconciled with each other in Egypt, becomes, as it were, a prefiguration. It is a hint at things to come, right? Just as their rivalry presaged the rivalry between the two kingdoms that bore their names, the fact that in this week's Sidra they achieve some sort of reconciliation, that presages the fact that ultimately there will be a reconciliation between all of the different parts of the Jewish people, politically and spiritually as well. And here I just want to call our attention again to a very similar use of symbolism, the symbolism of things either being torn apart, symbolizing division and rivalry, or being brought together to symbolize reconciliation and unification. I mentioned, you can see on the very top line of this text, I apologize that it's a bit, let's see if I can make it a bit larger. Ah, here we go. Okay. You can see in the very first line of this text, which is out of the 11th chapter of the first book of Kings, that it's speaking about Yarovam. You may remember just from a little while ago, I mentioned the name Yarovam ben Nevat of the tribe of Ephraim, who was the first king of the northern kingdom of Israel. Okay. So this is the chapter that introduces us to him and introduces us to the fact that he is going to become a king who will rival the king of Judah in Jerusalem. And the way the story is told is that he is met along the way by a prophet, a Navi, named Achiah HaShiloni, Achiah from Shiloh. And it says that Achiah was wearing a simla chadasha. I know that in modern Hebrew, a simla is usually confined to a dress. No, Achiah was not cross-dressing. Simla basically means an outer garment. Okay, so he was wearing a new coat, let's say, right? A new coat, right? What happens now? In verse 30, Achiah takes hold of the new garment that he was wearing and he tears it into 12 pieces. And he says to Yerovaam, you take 10 of these pieces because you're going to become the king of 10 tribes. That will leave over 2 pieces, and those 2 pieces, so to speak, will belong to, right, to Rehavaam, the son of King Solomon, who was the king who was ruling in Jerusalem at the time, because the kingdom of Judah consisted of 2 tribes, the 2 tribes in whose territory the temple was situated, the tribe of Yehuda, along with the tribe of Ephraim. I'm sorry, the tribe of Binyamin. So, as I said, we also have some acquaintance, along with the symbolism of separate items being fused together, we're also acquainted with the opposite symbolism, the symbolism of a whole that is taken apart. Okay. And now the Haftarah comes to its conclusion, and it tells us who is going to be that one king who will rule over the unified kingdom of Israel. Vavdi David melech aleihem. The king will be King David. V'ra'e echad yihye l'chulam. He will be their single shepherd. Uv mishpatay elechu. And again, we combine the political with the spiritual. They will follow in God's ordinances. Chukotay yishmeru. They will observe his statutes. Va'asu otam. And they will perform them. V'yashavu al ha'aretz asher natati l'avdi Yaakov. They will take up residence in the land that was promised to the patriarchs, in which their ancestors had lived, and they and their children and their grandchildren will continue to live there ad olam, forever and ever. V'David avdi nasi lahem l'olam, and the Lord's servant David will be their prince, their king, forever. Clearly, an allusion to what is not so-called in biblical literature, but what in rabbinic literature becomes the figure of Mashiach ben David. Okay, not clear at all from even rabbinic literature whether the Mashiach ben David is going to be a reincarnation of David himself, or whether he's simply just going to be a lineal descendant of David. But in any event, this is at least the first hint at this. And at this moment in time, God says, "V'charati lahem brit shalom, brit olam yihyeh otam." God, at that time in the future, will forge a new covenant with the Jewish people, a covenant that will be marked by the characteristics or the attributes of peace, a brit olam, eternal, right? Unatatim v'hir beiti otam, and the Jewish people will multiply. V'natati et mikdashi b'tocham le'olam, and God's temple will again be situated in their midst, and again, but this time it will be in perpetuity. Vayiti lahem le'lohim v'hem yuli la'am, as we saw previously, they will once again be able to call themselves the people of God, and he will refer to himself, so to speak, as the Lord of Israel. V'yadu agoyim, and the entire world will come to know, ki ani Hashem mekadesh et Yisrael, that it is God who blesses the Jewish people and sanctifies them, b'hiyot mikdashi b'tocham le'olam, and that this is symbolized by the continuing presence in their midst of God's sanctuary, of the Beit HaMikdash, of the temple. I told you that this is the second half of chapter 37 in the book of Yechezkel. This is the first half of the chapter. It's the chapter of the dry bones. Right? The hand of the Lord was upon Ezekiel, and the spirit or the wind of the Lord took him, flew him out into a valley that was filled with bones. And he hovered over the valley, and he saw many bones, and the bones were very dry. And God says to him, "Atichyena ha'atzamot ha'ela, can these bones come back to life?" And the prophet says, "Hashem Elokim ata yada'ata, surely God, if you want them to come back to life, they will." And God says to him, "Yes, I can bring them back to life, but you're going to be part of the process." And he tells him, it's the fourth line of the Hebrew text, "Hinavel ha'atzamot ha'ela," prophesy, or perhaps bring the spirit of prophecy upon these bones, and say to them, you see the underlined passage, "Hinei ani mevivachem ruach v'chiyitem," that God will be, it will inspire them, literally inspire in the sense of bring breath into them, so that they can come back to life. "V'natati alechem gidim," and God will fashion sinews and place skin upon them. And indeed, beginning with verse 7, the prophet says that he prophesied it, he had been instructed. And first thing that happened, as you know, is that the bones came together until they formed skeletons, and then sinews and flesh covered the skeletons. And then he calls to the wind, and the wind comes and enters the skeletons and inspires them, and they come back to life. And in verse 11, God says to him, "Ben Adam," as we've noted, that's how the prophet Yechezkel refers to himself. Ha'atzamot ha'ela, what do these dried bones that have been brought back to life, what do they represent? Kol Beit Yisrael hema. They represent the entire house of Israel. As we see as we saw already in the second half of this same chapter, not only the Jews in Babylonia who were of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, but including also the 10 tribes who had been exiled previously by the Assyrians. Hine Omerim, the house of Israel, the Jewish people living in exile, had been saying of themselves, Yavishu Atzmotenu, our bones are dry. Aveda tikvatenu, our hope, that is to say, the hope of being brought back to life, is lost, right? Nigzarnu lanu, we are fated to remain as dry bones. And therefore, God says to the prophet and through the prophet to the house of Israel that if they thought that they were dead, right, then they're now going to experience tchiyat hamitim, the resurrection of the dead. And therefore, when it now continues in the Haftarah that we looked at, and God addresses the prophet and says, now bring the two wooden slates together to represent the unification of the descendants of Judah and of the house of Judah, the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Joseph, we can see that he's talking about the people who the day before, so to speak, thought that they had no hope, thought that they were doomed to simply dry up and be blown away in exile. And now they were going to be revived through a rekindling of their hopes. You notice that I underlined in red the words Avedat Tikvatenu, just to take the opportunity to remind us that this was the inspiration for a poem that was originally called Tikvatenu, Our Hope, that was written by a Eastern European Jewish poet who also spent a considerable amount of time here in New York City, by the name of Naftali Tzvi Imber. And his poem, Tikvatenu, that originally had about 10 stanzas, is best known for the first of those stanzas, which subsequently became the hymn of the Zionist movement, and later the national anthem of the State of Israel, Hatikva. So when in the refrain of Hatikva, the poem says, Od lo aveda tikvatenu, you can see that he is responding directly to the prophecy of the Navi Yechezkel. And he is saying to the Jewish people of the late 19th, early 20th century, who living wherever they were, whether it was in Eastern Europe, in Russia, or whether it was here in the United States, who were saying of themselves, Yavshu atzmotenu, we're only dry bones. Avda tikvatenu, we have no hope of resurrection, of reunification. Nigzarnu lanu, we're fated. He was saying to them, you're wrong, od lo avda tikvatenu, our hope has not been lost. I have one last thing to bring to your attention. If I'm correct, and I'm not going to take the credit for it. If Ramban was correct in pointing out Ma'aseh Avot Siman Levanim, that deeds or activities conducted by the patriarchs are an omen, so to speak, for their children. If we've seen how the rivalry and subsequently the reconciliation between Yehuda and Yosef are reflected later in Jewish history in the kingdoms that bore their names, and if we saw in this week's Haftarah that God says that in the future they will be united and but one single king will rule over them, it seems to me that there's a piece of the puzzle that's missing. And that is that if there is going to be a Mashiach ben David, a Messiah from the tribe of Judah, who is going to represent his tribe, then shouldn't there be a Mashiach ben Yosef? Shouldn't there be a comparable Messiah from the tribe of Joseph? Well, what do you know? There is a single passage in the Talmud. It's a single passage, and because it's only a single passage, not too much can be said about it definitively. But there is a passage in the Tractate Sukkah that reads, as you can see in front of you, Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Mashiach ben David she'atid lehigalot bimhera bi'amenu. Right, the Messiah, son of David, may he reveal himself speedily in our days. Omer lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God says to him as follows, Sha'al mimeni davar ve'eten lach. Ask of me anything you wish and I will grant your wish. Get down to the skip to the third line. So what did he wish for? Kevan she'ra'a Mashiach ben Yosef she'neherag. When the Messiah, the son of David, saw that the Messiah, the son of Joseph, would be slain, Omer lefanav, he said to God, Eini mevakesh mimcha el achayim. Right? Just tell me I'm not going to be killed and I'll be happy. I don't need anything else. So there is an allusion here to a figure who is called Mashiach ben Yosef. But unlike the Mashiach ben David, who is going to be the successful Mashiach, the implication or the intimation seems to be that the Mashiach ben Yosef will be an unsuccessful Mashiach. And there is some speculation, there is some further speculation about this, not in the Talmud itself, but actually in medieval Jewish literature, where people either wrote midrashim about it, or in some cases composed liturgical poems, piyutim, about it. And the consensus seems to be that the Mashiach ben Yosef is kind of like a precursor to Mashiach ben David, that the Mashiach ben Yosef will come and he will engage the enemies of Israel in battle, in the battle that the prophet Yechezkel talks about in one of the closing chapters of his own book, the battle, the apocalyptic battle that has come to be known as the Battle of Gog Magog, but that the Mashiach ben Yosef is going to be slain during that battle. And then subsequently the Mashiach ben David will come and he will then be able to deliver Israel from the hands of its enemies, and the kingdom that he establishes will be the one unifying kingdom and it will last in perpetuity. And there we go. So, have we, I will have a quick look at the chat. Do we know who Rabbi Akiva's son was? There is some passage. I'm not recalling for exactly the name. Yes, we do know something. There is a passage in Talmudic literature that actually cites a name of someone and says that he is the son of Rabbi Akiva, but it just escapes me. How do I know that Akiva's luach was made of wood? First of all, because it's an interesting question. I will tell you that if we'd started with the midrashic text, and it said, and that was our first encounter with luach, and somebody had said, well, what was the luach made of? I said, well, clearly it's made of wood because that's what a luach is made of in chapter 37 of the prophet Ezekiel. But that's kind of like a tautology. I can't prove that in Ezekiel. I can't prove it from Ezekiel, from Avot Rabbi Natan, and then prove it from Avot Rabbi Natan to Ezekiel. But I'm assuming that it was, because it's not likely that they had invented slate or blackboards in those days. There's no evidence of it, neither physical evidence nor literary evidence. I can also tell you something else. If they were the only two people who had to share that wooden slate, then they were probably seated side by side. But we know from other instances in Jewish history that there were times at which, reasons that we can well understand, writing surfaces or writing implements were at a premium. In Yemen, for example, it happened frequently that a teacher did not have enough textbooks, so to speak, writing slates or textbooks for the number of children who were learning to read. And therefore, what you had was several children sharing either a writing slate or a textbook. And therefore, some of them had to sit on the other side. And they're indeed, it's well known in Yemenite Jewish folklore and in memoirs of Yemenite Jews as recently as those who lived there in the first half of the 20th century, that there were among them those who learned how to read upside down. Because I guess the teacher's favorites got to sit with the text facing them correctly, and the ones who weren't so favorite had to sit on the other side and had to learn how to read upside down. Okay. Oh, that's very cute. Yechezkel's atzamot were revived with atzmaot. That's very nice. It's also curious that it's not something that we read on Yom HaAtzmaut, but yes, it's nice. It's nice. Thank you, Shimon ben Rabbi Akiva. I wonder why Tova Shimon knows that. Okay, that's it. That we seem to be to have taken the chat into. Oh, I have one thing. I got one thing. Hold on. I got a special for you. Give me one second here, and I'm going to, this is just the text of HaTikva. I got a special for you. Who knows what today's date is on the Jewish calendar?
The day they translated the Torah into Greek.
Ah, so, that was Wednesday. I mean,
Wednesday
was the 8th of Tevet.
I'm sorry?
But unless you're on the West Coast, or I guess even on the West Coast, the sun must have set by now. It's already the 9th of Tevet. Okay. And it happens to be not particularly well known. And
Ezra has Sofer's Yahrzeit.
Pardon?
Ezra has Sofer's Yahrzeit.
Yeah, well, you may regret my telling you this, but the 8th of Tevet was supposed to be a fast day, and so was the 9th of Tevet. And don't take my word for it. Here is the Se'if in the Shulchan Aruch. Okay? It's in Siman Tav Kof Pei, which is called Hilchot Ta'anit. Laws pertain to lesser fast days. And it says, Bishmona b'Tevet nechtava Torah Yevanit b'mei Talmai HaMelech. That the 8th of Tevet was the anniversary of the Septuagint, the day in which the Torah was translated into Greek during the reign of King Ptolemy. And the world was darkened for 3 days. But then it adds and it says, Uvetetbo, on the 9th day of Tevet, there's a fast day. Lo no da ezohi hatzara she'erabo. We fast on the 9th of Tevet, right? But we don't know what we're fasting for. Now, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. So, you know, here's the Mishnah Brura telling us, what do you mean we don't know? Uvislichot shalanu, that we do have a liturgical poem that records that the 9th of Tevet, Shemet Ezra HaSofer, that it's the yard side of Ezra HaSofer. And believe me, if you don't think that's cause enough to fast, I can find you other sources that say that it was coincidentally, it was also the yard side of Nehemiah. So if you don't think that it's worth fasting just in memory of Ezra HaSofer, you might be persuaded to fast if you thought that it were the yahrzeit of both Ezra and Nehemiah. But here's something else. Tomorrow night, right, is known by some people as Nittelnacht. Okay? And there are those who maintain that the word Nittel, which has no meaning, right, it is actually an acronym. It's Rashi Tevot, standing for Nolad Yeshu, Jesus was born, Tet LeTevet, on the 9th day of Tevet. And guess what? In the 11th, 12th centuries, there was a Spanish Jewish, a very well-known and highly regarded Spanish Jewish mathematician and astronomer named Avraham Barjia, some of whose astronomical tables were so highly regarded and were so accurate that 400 years later, they were used by Christopher Columbus to cross the Atlantic. Avraham Barjia wrote a book called Luchot HaIbur, data, laws, and astronomical data necessary in order to compute the Jewish calendar. And he made the following observation. He observed that the 10th, the 9th of the lunar month of Tevet, immediately preceding the first year of the Common Era, was December 25th, which implies that the rabbis instituted a Ta'anit Tzibur, a public fast day, to mark Christmas, but they were astute enough not to spell out the reason, so that there was a tradition that made its way all the way till the Shulchan Aruch in the 16th century and continues through the Mishnah Brura in the 20th century that says, Taka, we fast on the 9th of Tevet, even though we don't really know, or read parenthetically, even though we're really not prepared to publicly declare what the reason is for that fast day. And with that, I can take my leave of you.
No, so as you were speaking, I don't remember what he says, but I do remember that Schneer Lyman, the great historian, the great, who knows everything about everything, has an article on the fast of the 9th of Tevet, this mysterious comment. We don't know what happened. So I just put it into the Lyman Library, if you ever want to see the website. So it has a number of his articles. So I just have to reread it, but I just put in the chat box, Schneer Lyman's article on what happened on 9th of Tevet. I don't remember, but yes, I do recall some claim the 9th of Tevet, you know, Jesus's birthright. That's, I assume Mark Shapiro will talk about that a little bit tomorrow evening when he discusses the Minhag, or if we can call it that, is not in our world, I don't think, of not learning Torah on Tish. But there are people who are machmir all year not to learn, lest they may come to learn on Nitalnach, you know, or Tisha B'Av. You know, that's the old bad joke. But anyways, but thank you. I was going to say one other thing. Oh, yeah, what you were saying on the people learning to read upside down. So that's what they say. I also don't think it's true, of course, but I remember in high school, one of my teachers told me, that's why we shuckle. Because they didn't have enough sidurim or enough gemaras, so when people had to learn, like everybody had to take turns, so they would go backwards. So one guy would look and read and go back, and the next guy would go. So that's how shocking developed when you dub. No, I don't think it's true, but it's you know, it's.
So I'll tell you.
Purim Torah.
I'll tell you a true thing about availability of gemaras. You know that there are certain tractates, certain masechtot of the Talmud that are considered the yeshivish, right? The ones that traditionally get studied in higher Jewish academies of learning. They were the remainders. If you go back to Poland in the 16th century, you find out that no yeshiva had enough students to be able to place an order for whatever it wanted. Therefore, what they had to do was one of two things. They either had to get several yeshivas together and place a combined order with a printer, or they simply had to settle for whatever the printer had in his stock. So a lot of what we think are chosen, the tractates that were chosen, because we think that the education committee of the Vad Arba Aratzot, you know, sat and day and night and tried to figure out what are those, you know, masechtos of the Shas that everybody has to know and that will make the best contribution. In many cases, it's just simply what was available.